testing.
They each reported significant improvement, and all six officers went back to work. Their follow-up scans all showed calming of the hyperactive areas. PTSD can be acute or chronic. It can occur right after a terrible event, or even appear years after the fact. It can also be chronic after years of abuse or growing up in an unpredictable and stressful home, such as with an alcoholic or drug-abusing parent. During my psychiatric training, I studied children and grandchildren of alcoholics. It was clear that persistent early childhood trauma could reset the activity in children's brains to a higher than normal level, setting them up for emotional problems later in life. Conflict avoidance. Anxiety is, by definition, very uncomfortable. Thus, people who are anxious tend to avoid any situation that might make them more uncomfortable, especially dealing with conflict. People who have basal ganglia problems tend to be frozen by conflict and consequently do what they can to avoid it. Unfortunately, conflict avoidance can have a serious negative impact on your life. Lauren, the owner of a neighborhood deli, hated conflict. He also had problems with chronic feelings of tension and anxiety. His fear of confrontation prevented him from firing employees who were not good for his business. It also caused him to be overly nice to people who were negative to him, so Lauren grew to resent his own lack of assertiveness. His problems even caused marital difficulties. For years, Lauren wouldn't talk about the things in his marriage that made him unhappy. He would just hold them in until he finally exploded. Learning to deal with conflict was the centerpiece of his treatment. Tourette syndrome, TS. TS is a very interesting disorder that provides the bridge between the basal ganglia and two seemingly opposite disorders, attention deficit disorder, ADD, and obsessive compulsive disorder, OCD. TS is characterized by motor and vocal tics lasting more than a year. Motor tics are involuntary physical movements such as eye blinking, head jerking, shoulder shrugging, and arm or leg jerking. Vocal tics typically involve making involuntary noises such as coughing, puffing, blowing, barking, and sometimes swearing, coprolalia. TS runs in families and may be associated with several genetic abnormalities found in the dopamine family of genes. SPECT studies of TS patients by the Amen Clinics and others have found abnormalities in the basal ganglia. One of the most fascinating aspects of TS is its high association with both ADD and OCD. It is estimated that 60% of people with TS have ADD and 50% have OCD. On the surface, it would appear that these are opposing disorders. People with ADD have trouble paying attention, while people with OCD pay too much attention to their negative thoughts, obsessions, or behaviors, compulsions. In looking further at patients with both ADD and OCD, I have found a high association of each disease in their family histories. So, for example, people with ADD often have relatives with OCD-like features, and people with OCD have people in their families with ADD. There is even a subtype of ADD that has been termed over-focused ADD. Affected people have symptoms of both inattention and over-focus. A crash course in the neurotransmitters, chemical messengers that help the brain to function, dopamine and serotonin is necessary here. In the brain, there tends to be a balancing mechanism between dopamine and serotonin. This balance, however, tends to be played out in the basal ganglia. Dopamine is involved with motor movements, motivation, attention span, and setting the body's idle speed, while serotonin is more involved with mood control, shifting attention, and cognitive flexibility. When something happens in the brain to raise dopamine levels, serotonin becomes less effective, and when serotonin levels are raised, dopamine becomes less effective. For example, when I give someone a psychostimulant to treat ADD, it works by effectively raising the availability of dopamine in the basal ganglia. Thus, it helps with focus, follow-through, and motivation. If I give him too much, he may become obsessive, moody, and inflexible, symptoms of too little serotonin. Likewise, if I give someone who has ADD a medication that enhances serotonin availability in the brain, such as a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, SSRI, his ADD symptoms are likely to become worse, but he won't care that they are worse and will also show lowered motivation. Since the basal ganglia are involved with dopamine production, low in ADD, and have been found to be overactive in OCD in conjunction with the anterior cingulate gyrus, the basal ganglia are likely significantly involved in all three of these disorders. Blocking dopamine with certain antipsychotic medications like risperidone, Risperdal, helps to suppress tics, but makes ADD symptoms worse. Psychostimulants such as Ritalin, methylphenidate, or Adderall, a combination of amphetamine salts, help ADD symptoms, but have a variable effect on tics. They may make them better or worse. Also, as mentioned, psychostimulants tend to exacerbate OCD symptoms and cause people to focus more on the thoughts or behaviors that bother them. An interference mechanism in the basal ganglia is likely to be part of the picture, upsetting the dopamine-serotonin balance in the brain. I once gave a lecture to the Tourette Syndrome Foundation of Canada. I was in a room with 400 people with TS, many of whom exhibited both motor tics, head shaking, shoulder shrugs, etc., and vocal tics such as honking, barking, and in some cases, swearing. About halfway through my lecture, someone yelled loudly, "Fuck you," which made me catch my breath. No one had said that to me since my first wife. I chose to ignore the comment, hoping it wouldn't recur. Then about 3 minutes later, "Fuck you," came from the audience. Now I started to sweat, but still didn't say anything. Then a few minutes later, the F-bomb filled the air. I stopped the lecture and found the person who was shouting out and asked, "Is that a tick? Or don't you like the lecture?" He turned red and replied, "I'm so sorry. I like the lecture." But how did I really know? Fine motor problems. As discussed earlier, fine motor problems, like handwriting issues, are often associated with low basal ganglia activity. Another interesting connection that is probably related to basal ganglia hyperactivity is the development of fine motor tremors when we become anxious. When I was a young lecturer in front of an audience, I didn't hold papers in my hands because I was concerned the paper might start to rattle or shake in response to the anxiety I felt. When the basal ganglia are overactive, we are more at risk for increased muscle tension or tremors. In my practice, I have often prescribed the medication propranolol to calm the tremors musicians get during a performance. Increased muscle tension related to overactive basal ganglia activity is often associated with headaches. I have noticed that a number of people with resistant headaches have intense focal areas of increased activity in the basal ganglia. This seems to occur with both muscle contraction headaches, often described as a pain in the back of the neck or as a tight band around the forehead, and migraines, usually one-sided throbbing headaches that may be preceded by a visual aura or other warning phenomena. Interestingly, anticonvulsant medications such as topiramate, Topamax, which decreases areas of overactivity in the brain, is often helpful in decreasing some types of headaches. Low and high motivation. As stated earlier, motivation tends to be low in dopamine-deficient states, such as ADD. However, when serotonin levels are raised too high, decreased motivation also becomes a problem. Physicians know that if a dose of serotonin-enhancing antidepressants is too high, lowered motivation is often the result. Many people have told me that they stop these medications because with them, they stop doing things that were important to their business or home life. One CEO told me he stopped taking his SSRI because he realized he wasn't keeping up with his paperwork and he really didn't care. "That's not like me," he said. Heightened dopamine or basal ganglia states may also cause increased or even excessive motivation. As I mentioned earlier, we found that many CEOs of corporations have enhanced basal ganglia activity. They also tend to work excessive hours. In fact, weekends tend to be the hardest time for these people. During the week, they charge through the day, getting things done. On the weekend, during unstructured time, they often complain of feeling restless, anxious, and out of sorts. Relaxation is foreign to them. In fact, it is downright uncomfortable. Workaholics may be made in the basal ganglia. Their internal idle speed or energy level doesn't allow them to rest. Of course, there is a positive correlate. Many of the people in society who make things happen are driven by basal ganglia that keep them working for long periods of time. Basal ganglia checklist. Here is a basal ganglia system checklist. Please listen to the list of behaviors and rate yourself or the person you are evaluating on each behavior listed. 5 or more symptoms, mark 3 or 4, indicate a high likelihood of basal ganglia issues. 0 equals never. 1 equals rarely. 2 equals occasionally, 3 equals frequently, 4 equals very frequently. 1. Feelings of nervousness or anxiety. 2. Symptoms of heightened muscle tension, headaches, sore muscles, hand tremor. 3. Feeling keyed up or on edge. 4. Quick to startle. 5. Tendency to freeze in anxiety-provoking situations. 6. Excessive fear of being judged or scrutinized by others. 7. Conflict avoidance. 8. Lacking confidence. 9. Sensitive to criticism. 10. Biting fingernails or picking at skin. 11. Always watching for bad things to happen. 12. Excessive motivation. 13. Tics. 14. Poor handwriting. Chapter 9. Stop feeling nervous now. Basal ganglia prescriptions. 4 ways to break an anxiety attack. I should know. In 1989, I wrote an article for Parade magazine called How to Get Out of Your Own Way. After the article was published, my office received more than 10,000 letters asking for more information about how to stop self-defeating behavior. CNN even asked me to be on one of their shows. It was to be my first time on TV, and while I was in the green room waiting to go on, I started to feel very anxious. I had trouble breathing, and my heart started to race. I felt so uncomfortable, I wanted to run out of the studio. Fortunately, the little voice in my head started to laugh at me and said, "You treat people who have this problem. What do you tell them to do?" There are four simple steps. In fact, I often write them on a memo pad and hand it to my patients. 1. Breathe. Slow down your breathing. During anxiety attacks, breathing becomes erratic, shallow, and rapid. Your brain is the most metabolically active organ in your body. Any state that lowers oxygen will trigger fear and panic. By taking slow, deep breaths, you'll boost oxygen to your brain and start to regain control over how you feel. When I was in the green room, I did that and felt calmer. We'll discuss breathing techniques in more detail later in the chapter. 2. Don't leave. If I had left the studio, I wouldn't have gone back and might never have accepted another invitation to appear on TV again. So I didn't leave. 3. Write down your thoughts. If your thoughts are distorted, talk back to them. My first thought was, "I am going to forget my name." Now that was funny because it was unlikely they would ask my name. They already knew it. They had invited me. Then I thought, "I'm going to stutter. 2 million people are going to think I am an idiot." I chuckled to myself. No wonder I wanted to run out of the studio. My brain was playing a horror film with me as the main victim. Fortunately for me, I knew how to talk back to these thoughts. So right there in the CNN studio in Los Angeles, I took out a piece of paper and did the anteater exercise. I drew 2 lines vertically down the paper, dividing it into 3 columns. In the first column, I wrote down the thoughts, unedited as they occurred in my brain. In the second column, I wrote down the type of ant it was. See Chapter 7 for a refresher course on this exercise. In the third column, I killed the ants by talking back to them. So in the first column, I wrote the initial thought, "I am going to forget my name." In the middle column, I wrote fortune-telling, where I was predicting the worst, the most common ant among people who have panic attacks. In the third column, I wrote, "I've never forgotten my name, but if I do, I have my driver's license in my wallet." Playing with the thoughts helps you see how absurd they can be. Below the first ant, I wrote out the second one, "I am going to stutter." In the middle column, I wrote fortune-telling, because I was still predicting disaster in the future. And in the third column, I wrote, "Probably not. I usually don't stutter, but if I do, there will be people who stutter in the audience who will now have a doctor they can relate to." Having fun with the thoughts helps you disarm them. Then I wrote the last thought, 2 million people will think you are an idiot. In the middle column, I wrote mind reading. I was predicting what the audience was thinking even before I had said anything. In the third column, I wrote, "Maybe so." Next to it, I wrote 3 numbers, 18, 40, 60, which stands for a rule I teach my patients called the 18-40-60 rule. It says that when you are 18, you worry about what everyone thinks of you. When you are 40, you don't give a damn what anybody thinks about you. And when you're 60, you realize No one has been thinking about you at all. People spend their days worrying and thinking about themselves, not you. 4. Take calming supplements or medications to help if needed. Remember that this is the last step, to be used if the first three aren't effective. This 5-minute exercise helped me relax, and I was able to go on the show and do well. If I had run out of the studio, I probably never would have gone back, and it would have dramatically changed my life and career. Now my television programs have aired over 80,000 times across North America. Don't let your aunts steal your dreams and your ability to do good things in the world. The following prescriptions will help you soothe stress and enhance your overall sense of calm and relaxation. They are based on what we have learned about the basal ganglia and other areas of the brain that generate anxiety and angst, such as the amygdala and insular cortex, as well as my clinical experience with patients. Biological, diaphragmatic breathing, hand warming, heart rate variability training, supplements and medications, nutritional interventions. Psychological, ant therapy, especially for fortune-telling ants, self-hypnosis and guided imagery, meditation, relaxation response, EMDR. Social, learning how to deal with conflict. Spiritual, finding your purpose and passion. Biological basal ganglia prescriptions. Biological, diaphragmatic breathing, 5 times 2 equals 10. Breathe slowly and deeply, mostly with your belly, taking 5 seconds to inhale, then holding it for 2 seconds, then 5 seconds to exhale, and 2 more seconds to hold your exhalation. Repeat for 10 breaths. This is one of the main exercises I teach my patients who have panic disorders. The purpose of breathing is to get oxygen from the air into your body and to blow off waste products such as carbon dioxide. Every cell in your body needs oxygen in order to function. Brain cells are particularly sensitive to oxygen as they start to die within minutes when they are deprived of it. Slight changes in oxygen content in the brain can alter the way a person feels and behaves. When a person gets angry, his or her breathing pattern changes almost immediately. Breathing becomes shallower and significantly faster. This breathing pattern is inefficient, and the oxygen content in the angry person's blood is lowered. Subsequently, there is less oxygen available to a person's brain, and he or she may become more irritable, impulsive, confused, and prone to negative behavior, such as yelling, threatening, or hitting another person. Let your breath relax you. Sit in a chair. Get comfortable. Close your eyes, unless you're driving. Put one hand on your chest and one hand on your belly. Then, for several minutes, feel the rhythm of your breathing. Do you breathe mostly with your chest? Mostly with your belly? Or with both your chest and belly? The way you breathe has a huge impact on how you feel. Have you ever watched a baby breathe or a puppy? They breathe almost exclusively with their bellies. They move their upper chest very little in breathing, yet most adults breathe almost totally from the upper part of their chest. To correct this negative breathing pattern, lie on your back and place a small book on your belly. When you breathe in, make the book go up. And when you breathe out, make the book go down. Shifting the center of breathing lower in your body will help you feel more relaxed and in better control of yourself. Practice this diaphragmatic breathing in the 5 × 2 = 10 pattern several times a day to help you develop a deeper sense of calm and peace. This has been one of the most helpful exercises for me personally. When I first learned how to breathe diaphragmatically, I discovered my baseline breathing rate was 24 breaths a minute, and I breathed mostly with my upper chest. I had spent 10 years in the military being taught to stick my chest out and suck my gut in, the opposite of what is good for breathing. Learning how to quiet my breathing helped calm my anxiety and help me feel more settled overall. I still use it to calm my nerves before tough meetings, speaking engagements, and media appearances. I also use it in conjunction with self-hypnosis to help me sleep when I feel stressed. My current baseline breathing rate is less than 10 times a minute. Biological, hand warming. A fascinating technique that supports relaxation is learning how to warm your hands with your brain. By using mental images of activities that warm the hands, such as putting your hands in front of a warm fire, holding a cup of hot green tea, touching your partner's warm skin, or sitting in a hot tub, many people can actually increase the temperature in their hands and induce a generalized relaxed brain and body state. Whenever we are stressed, our hands get cold because blood is being shunted away from the hands and feet to the large muscles of our shoulders and hips, preparing us to fight or flee. Even though you might be feeling stressed about a big project at work or a fight you had with a friend, your body reacts in some ways as it would have when your biggest stressor was encountering a saber-toothed tiger. Warming your hands counteracts the stress response and increases parasympathetic tone and relaxation. There are a number of studies that report lowered blood pressure with hand warming. In one study from Korea, it was used to treat patients with hypertension. A significant decline of the systolic and diastolic blood pressure was observed in the treatment group. Biological, heart rate variability, HRV, training. HRV training is another important way to lower stress and increase a sense of peace. Heart rate variability is the beat-to-beat variation in heart rhythm. Most people think that a healthy heart rhythm is perfectly regular. Not so. Even under normal healthy conditions, our heart rhythm bounces around. High HRV, or heart rate variability, has been associated with heart and brain health, while low HRV has been associated with illness. HRV issues can become apparent when mothers deliver babies. Obstetricians typically monitor the baby's HRV before delivery with scalp monitors. In a healthy baby, the heart rate varies significantly. If the baby's heart rate becomes too steady, the baby is considered to be in trouble. Lower HRV is a sign of distress, whether we are about to be born or are adults. HRV has been found to predict survival after heart attacks. Over a dozen well-designed studies have shown that reduced HRV predicts sudden death in patients who have had a heart attack. Studies also suggest that lower HRV may predict risk of death even among individuals free of heart disease. Knowing what you now know about the relationship between our brains and physical health, it might not surprise you to learn that studies also show a relationship between high levels of anxiety and heart disease. Many other studies have suggested a link between negative emotions such as anxiety and hostility and reduced HRV. One research group reported an association between anxiety and reduced HRV in 581 men, while another group observed lower HRV in individuals who are highly anxious. The exciting news is that you can train your HRV. I often recommend HRV trainers such as those found at www.heartmath.com. They have an Inner Balance iOS app as well as a standalone device, MWave 2, and a computer program that both kids and adults love, MWave Pro. Biological. Consider basal ganglia supplements or medications from the Amen Clinics method algorithm. At Amen Clinics, we use the following algorithm when we see high basal ganglia activity plus symptom clusters of anxiety. Supplements for high basal ganglia activity plus anxiety. Many supplements have anti-anxiety properties. Some of my favorites include magnesium, 80% of the population is low in it, theanine from green tea, the calming amino acid GABA, ashwagandha, rhalora, and valerian root. B vitamins, especially vitamin B6, in doses of 25 to 100 milligrams, have also been found by some to be helpful. If you take B6 at these doses, it is important to take a B-complex supplement as well. My patients have also found the scents from essential oils of chamomile and lavender to be calming. Medications for high basal ganglia activity plus anxiety. Anti-anxiety medications can be very helpful for more severe anxiety problems. I tend to stay away from medications such as diazepam, Valium, alprazolam, Xanax, clonazepam, Klonopin, and lorazepam, Ativan. Typical benzodiazepines such as these suppress brain activity, make the brains of many look toxic, shriveled or low in activity, and have been recently associated with an increased risk of dementia. Buspirone, is a non-benzodiazepine medication that can be helpful in treating long-term anxiety. It also has the benefit of not being addictive, but may take a few weeks to be effective. Certain antidepressants such as imipramine, tofranil, and the MAO inhibitor phenelzine, Nardil, are especially helpful for people who have panic disorders. The anticonvulsants gabapentin, Neurontin, and lamotrigine, Lamictal, can be useful for resistant anxiety, especially when there is excessive basal ganglia activity. See Chapter 16 to learn more about the 7 types of anxiety and depression. Biological, nutritional interventions. The food you eat has an important effect on how you feel and your levels of stress and anxiety. In my experience, people with high anxiety do better eating small meals throughout the day so they do not get hungry. Hypoglycemia, low blood sugar, is a major cause of anxiety disorders and includes the following symptoms: periods of feeling confused, dizzy, lightheaded, irritable, anxious, panicky, or shaky, sweating, or feeling faint. If you have 3 or more of the above 9 symptoms, it is a good idea to have a 2-hour glucose tolerance test to see if hypoglycemia is an issue for you. If you have low basal ganglia activity and low motivation, you will likely do better with a high-protein, low-carbohydrate diet that gives you more energy during the day. It is also often helpful to eliminate caffeine, as it may worsen anxiety. Eliminating alcohol is often a good idea as well. Even though alcohol decreases anxiety in the short term, withdrawal from alcohol causes anxiety and places a person with anxiety at more risk for alcohol addiction. Psychological basal ganglia prescriptions. Psychological. Ant therapy, especially for fortune-telling ants. As you heard in my story at the beginning of the chapter, people who struggle with anxiety or panic are often experts at predicting the worst. We have an abundance of fortune-telling ants. Learning to overcome the tendency toward pessimistic predictions is essential to bringing peace to your life. Through the years, I have met many people who tell me that they're pessimists. They say that if they expect the worst to happen in a situation, they will never be disappointed. While this may be true, it's also true that they're likely to die earlier. The constant stress from negative predictions lowers immune system effectiveness and increases the risk of becoming ill. Your thoughts affect every cell in your body. Learning how to kill the fortune-telling ants that go through your mind is essential to effectively dealing with the anxiety generated in this part of the brain. Whenever you feel anxious or tense, try the following steps. Write down the event that is causing you anxiety. For example, having to get up in front of people to give a speech. Notice and write down the automatic thoughts that come into your mind. Odds are, when you are anxious, your thoughts are predicting a negative outcome to a situation. Common anxiety-provoking thoughts include, they will think I'm stupid. Others will laugh at me. I will stumble on my words. I will shake and look nervous. Label or identify the thought as a fortune-telling ant if it's appropriate. Often just naming the thought can help take away its power. Talk back to the automatic negative thought and kill the ant. Write down a response to diffuse the negative thought. In this example, write something like, "Odds are they won't laugh, and I'll do a good job. If they do laugh, I'll laugh with them. I know that speaking in public is nerve-wracking for many people, and probably some people will feel empathy for me if I'm nervous." Do not accept every thought that comes into your mind. Thoughts are just thoughts, not facts. You can learn to change this pattern. Psychological. Use self-hypnosis and guided imagery. Self-hypnosis taps into your body's natural soothing power source that most people don't even know exists. It is found within you, within your ability to focus your attention. Hypnosis is a natural phenomenon. It is an altered state we frequently go into and out of. Some natural examples of hypnosis include highway hypnosis, in which our sense of time and consciousness becomes altered. Have you ever taken a long trip and not remembered a town you drove through? Or has a period of a couple of hours passed in what seemed like only 20 or 30 minutes? Time distortion is a common trait of hypnotic states. Have you ever become so engrossed in a good book or a good movie that 2 hours rushed by in what seemed like minutes? We become so focused that we enter a hypnotic state. As you might imagine, because I have naturally overactive basal ganglia with a tendency toward anxiety, my medical internship year produced only more anxiety. When I worked on the cardiac intensive care unit, I had a lot of trouble getting to sleep at night because I was so anxious over the condition of the patients under my care. Being tired the next day didn't help matters much. I had learned hypnosis as a medical student and even used it with the nursing staff to help them stop smoking and lose weight. I hadn't thought of using it on myself. Besides, I rationalized, I wasn't really very hypnotizable. Late one evening, one of my patients had problems getting to sleep. He requested a sleeping pill. I thought it might be a better idea to use hypnosis to help him sleep. He was agreeable, and it worked quickly. When I made rounds the next morning, the patient asked me what he was going to do that night when I wasn't on call. I taught him self-hypnosis and came up with several sleep prescriptions. It then dawned on me to use self-hypnosis on myself. I learned that self-hypnosis, like most things, is a skill that gets better with practice. I got to the point where I could put myself to sleep in less than 1 minute through a simple self-hypnotic technique. Good sleep also helps calm anxiety. Sleep deprivation makes everything worse. Here are the simple self-hypnotic steps I use personally to help me sleep. Lie on your back with your hands at your sides. Pick a spot on the wall that is a little bit above your eye level. Stare at the spot. As you do, count slowly to 20. Notice that in a short while, your eyelids begin to feel heavy. Let your eyes close. In fact, even if they don't feel as if they want to close, slowly close them anyway as you get to 20. Next, take a deep breath, as deep as you can, and very slowly exhale. Repeat the deep inhale and slow exhale 3 times. With each breath in, feel your chest and belly rise and imagine breathing in peace and calmness. With each breath out, feel your chest and belly relax and blow out all the tension, all the things getting in the way of your relaxation. By this time, you'll notice a calm come over you. Next, tightly squeeze the muscles in your eyelids. Close your eyes as tightly as you can. Then slowly let the muscles in your eyelids relax. Notice how much more they have relaxed. Then imagine that relaxation spreading from the muscles in your eyelids to the muscles in your face, down your neck, into your shoulders and arms, into your chest, and throughout the rest of your body. The muscles will take the relaxation cue from your eyelids and relax progressively all the way down to the bottom of your feet. After your whole body feels relaxed, imagine yourself at the top of an escalator. Step on the escalator and ride down, slowly counting backwards from 20. By the time you reach the bottom, you're likely to feel very relaxed. Then add relaxation imagery. In your mind, choose a haven that promotes sleep. I like to go to a mountain cabin where there is snow outside and a crackling fire in the fireplace. Your haven can be a real or imagined place as long as it makes you feel relaxed. If sleep does not come right away, keep the imagery in your mind and start counting slowly from 1 to 1,000. In my experience, most people will fall asleep around 300. To make these steps easy to remember, think of the following words. Focus. Focus on the spot. Breathe. Slow, deep breaths. Relax. Progressive muscle relaxation. Down. Ride down the escalator. Imagery. Experience your haven with all of your senses. count until you are asleep. This technique can also be used to help you relax during waking hours. After the imagery stage, instead of letting your mind drift off to sleep, get back on the escalator riding up. Count to 10. When you get to 10, open your eyes, feel relaxed, refreshed, and wide awake. When you do this the first several times, allow yourself plenty of time. Some people become so relaxed that they fall asleep for several minutes. If that happens, don't worry. It's actually a good sign. You're really relaxed. If you want to have me as a personal guide in this process, you can join our Brain Warrior community, www.mybrainfitlife.com, where you'll have access to a number of different hypnosis audios. Psychological meditation. Decades of research have shown that meditation can calm stress and enhance brain function. At the Amen Clinics, we have published a brain spec study on a simple 12-minute Kundalini yoga form of meditation called Kirtan Kriya, in which we scanned 11 people on one day when they didn't meditate, and then the next day at the end of a meditation session. 12-minute meditation instructions. This 12-minute meditation involves chanting the simple sounds saw, ta, na, and ma while doing repetitive finger movements with both hands. You should be saying the sound once as you touch the corresponding fingers and then moving to the next. Touch thumbs to index fingers while chanting saw. Touch thumbs to middle fingers while chanting ta. Touch thumbs to ring fingers while chanting na. Touch thumbs to pinky fingers while chanting ma. Repeat the sounds for 2 minutes out loud. Repeat the sounds for 2 minutes in a whisper. Repeat the sounds for 4 minutes silently. Repeat the sounds for 2 minutes in a whisper. Repeat the sounds for 2 minutes out loud. When you finish, sit quietly for 1 to 2 minutes. Try to hold on to your calm mind and body throughout the day. In our study, the scans taken after the meditation showed marked decreases in activity in the left parietal lobes, demonstrating a decreasing awareness of time and space. They also showed significant increases in activity in the prefrontal cortex, which showed that meditation helped to tune people in, not out. We also observed increased activity in the right temporal lobe, an area that has been associated with spirituality. My colleagues eventually published other studies on this technique, one which appeared in the journal Consciousness and Cognition, found that this technique enhances blood flow to the front parts of the brain, including those involved in attention and emotion. The other study, published in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease, used brain spect imaging to evaluate the effects of meditation on memory in 15 people with memory problems due to normal aging or Alzheimer's disease. The results showed that after meditating every day for 8 weeks, the group's cerebral blood flow had increased in areas involved in retrieving memories. They also performed better on standardized tests that evaluate memory, cognition, and attention. My friend, Dr. Andy Newberg, at Thomas Jefferson University, has also used brain spect imaging to study the neurobiology of meditation. He scanned 9 Buddhist monks before and during prolonged meditation. The scans revealed distinctive changes in brain activity as the mind went into a meditative state, just like in the Kirtan Kriya meditation. Another functional brain imaging study of transcendental meditation, TM, showed calming in the anterior cingulate and basal ganglia, diminishing anxiety and worries, and fostering relaxation. The benefits of meditation go far beyond stress relief. Studies have shown that it also improves attention and planning, reduces depression and anxiety, decreases sleepiness, and protects the brain from cognitive decline associated with normal aging. In a study from researchers at UCLA, the hippocampus and frontal cortex were found to be significantly larger in people who meditate regularly. Meditation has also been found to aid in weight loss, reduce muscle tension, and even tighten the skin. A lot of people think it takes years to learn how to meditate. It doesn't. A fascinating Chinese study by the neuroscientist Dr. Yiwang Tang showed that people who received just 20 minutes of daily meditation training for 5 days showed a significant decrease in stress-related cortisol. You don't need to devote big chunks of time to the practice of meditation either. In my clinical practice, I often recommend meditation as an integral part of a treatment plan. Many of my patients have reported back that they feel calmer and less stressed after dedicating just a few minutes to daily meditation. You don't have to sit cross-legged on the floor or burn incense or do any of those things you might associate with meditation. It can be done anywhere, at any time. If you are at work, simply close the door to your office, sit in your chair, close your eyes, and relax for a few moments. At home, you can sit on the edge of your bed after you wake up and spend a few minutes calming your mind. Try the following technique for a simple introduction to meditation. The relaxation response. One of the simplest ways to meditate and reduce stress is a technique called the relaxation response developed by Herbert Benson, MD, at Harvard Medical School, which he outlines in his book, The Relaxation Response. Sit quietly in a comfortable position. Close your eyes. Deeply relax all your muscles, beginning at your feet and progressing up to your face. Keep them relaxed. Breathe through your nose. Become aware of your breathing. As you breathe out, say the word one, or some other relaxing word you choose, silently to yourself. For example, breathe in, and as you breathe out, say one, and then breathe in. And as you breathe out, say one. Continue for 10 to 20 minutes. You may open your eyes to check the time, but do not use an alarm. When you finish, sit quietly for several minutes, at first with your eyes closed, and later with your eyes open. Do not stand up for a few minutes after finishing. Do not worry about whether you are successful in achieving a deep level of relaxation. Maintain a passive attitude and permit relaxation to occur at its own pace. When distracting thoughts occur, try to ignore them by not dwelling upon them and return to repeating one. With practice, the response should come with little effort. Practice the technique once or twice daily, but not within 2 hours after any meal, since the digestive processes seem to interfere with the elicitation of the relaxation response. Psychological. Eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, EMDR. As I mentioned in the last chapter, EMDR can be a very powerful treatment for people who have been emotionally traumatized. EMDR uses eye movements or other alternate hemisphere stimulation to remove the emotional charges of traumatic memories. In 2004, CBS producer Angeline Chu called and asked if I would be interested in doing a story about EMDR using the following case as an example. Stephen and the Farmers Market Disaster. Stephen, a 33-year-old bicycle repair mechanic working in Santa Monica, California, took an early lunch on July 16, 2003. He was not sure why he needed to go to the downtown farmers market, but felt drawn to it. While he was walking, 87-year-old George Russell Weller lost control of his 1992 Buick LeSabre and barreled through the three-block-long farmers market. Bodies were flying, people were screaming, and Weller's car headed straight for Stephen, who later told me, "I thought he was going to run over my legs. I thought I would lose my legs." At the last possible moment, he was able to jump out of the way, but 10 people were killed and more than 50 were injured. Stephen, who had been a military tank commander in the first Gulf War, used the medical skills he learned to help save others. A woman died in his arms. Traumatized, Stephen went back to work. But for months, he couldn't sleep, and he shook constantly. By chance, or fate, if you believe in such things, Linda Alvarez, an anchor at CBS News in Los Angeles, took her bicycle to Stephen's shop shortly after the disaster. Linda and Stephen chatted about what had happened, and Linda noticed that Stephen was shaking. "It started that day," Stephen said, showing her his trembling hands, "and it won't stop." The image of Stephen's hands stayed with Linda. A month later, while working on another story, Linda learned about the work I was doing with EMDR. After talking to Stephen, who was a willing participant, I recruited a colleague of mine who was an EMDR expert to help. As in the case of most people who develop PTSD, the Santa Monica Farmers Market disaster was not Stephen's only trauma. He grew up in a severely abusive alcoholic home. One of his earliest memories is of his father burning down the family house. His father also once dangled him over a 400-foot bridge. At the age of 11, his favorite uncle, a firefighter, died in a fire set by an arsonist. As a young adult, Stephen faced death as a tank commander during the Gulf War. Clearly, Stephen had many layers of trauma. As part of his evaluation, we scanned Stephen 3 times, before treatment, during his first EMDR session, and after 8 hours of EMDR treatments. Initially, his brain showed the classic PTSD pattern, with an extremely active limbic area, basal ganglia, and anterior cingulate. We then went to work with Stephen, cleaning out the traumas, one by one, using EMDR. His brain actually showed benefit during the first treatment and was markedly improved after only 8 hours of treatment. Stephen's shaking had subsided, and he felt significantly better. One of the most touching things that happened during the process was that Stephen was able to forgive his father. He had held deep and understandable resentment toward his father, but the work with brain science gave him a new perspective. When we helped Stephen balance and change his brain, his life improved as well. You can learn more about EMDR at www.emdria.org. Social basal ganglia prescriptions. Social. Learn how to deal with conflict. As with relationships between countries, relationships between people are often devastated by peace at any price. Many people are so afraid of conflict that they do everything they can to avoid any turmoil. This conflict phobia actually sets up relationships for more trouble rather than less. Here are four typical scenarios of people who fear conflict. 1. In an attempt to be a loving parent, Sarah finds herself always giving in to her 4-year-old son's temper tantrums. She is frustrated by how much the tantrums have increased in frequency over the past year. She now feels powerless and gives in just to keep the peace. 2. Billy, a 10-year-old boy, was bullied by a bigger 10-year-old named Ryan. Ryan threatened to hurt Billy if he didn't give him his lunch money. To avoid being hurt, Billy gave in and spent the year terrified of Ryan. 3. Kelly found herself feeling very distant from her husband, Carl. She felt that he always tried to control her and treated her like a child. He would complain about how much money she spent, what she wore, and who her friends were. Even though this really bothered Kelly, she said little because she didn't want to fight. However, she found that her interest in sex was non-existent. She often felt tired and irritable, and she preferred to spend her free time with her friends rather than with Carl. 4. Bruce had worked as a foreman at Chet's company for 6 years, but for the past 4 years, Chet had become increasingly critical of Bruce and belittled him in front of others. For fear of losing his job, Bruce said nothing. But he became more depressed, started drinking more at home, and lost interest in his job. Whenever we give in to the temper tantrums of a child or allow someone to bully or control us, we feel terrible about ourselves. Our self-esteem suffers, and the relationship with that other person is damaged. In many ways, we teach other people how to treat us by what we tolerate and what we refuse to tolerate. Conflict phobics teach other people that it is okay to walk all over them, that there will be no consequences for misbehavior. In order to have any personal power in a relationship, we must be willing to stand up for ourselves and for what we know is right. This does not mean that we have to be mean or nasty. There are rational and kind ways to be firm, but firmness is essential. Let's look at how the people in each of the four examples could handle their situations in more productive ways.